is open. Good morning, everyone. We're going to get started with Senate Bill 845. Open up a public hearing on 845. Senator Boquist will be out today, excused. And so let's begin with a short summary from Mazzamelli.
Chair Hess and members of the committee, Senate Bill 845 does try to do one main thing, which is change the distribution of the revenue coming from the taxation of the marijuana, the legal marijuana, into a different way of doing things. And just to give you a quick way of how it used to be after Measure 91 was passed. Measure 91 was passed in November of 2014. After it was passed, the taxation was meant to be at $35 per ounce, and the distribution or it was at extraction or as first sale, and the tax at that time was meant to distribute at 40% to the common school fund, 20% to the mental health, alcoholism, and drug services, 15% to state police, and then 10% to cities, 10% to counties, and 5% to the Oregon Health Authority. Of course, after Measure 91, the legislature put together a joint committee to do some of the fixes that usually are done after the ballot measures come from votes. This is wasn't too unsimilar for Measure 47 that came later on to be a Measure 50. So 250 pages of law after that. we had fixed that new law and made those regulations. And the Joint Committee kind of put all these things together. And part of the changes was moving at least the taxation issue from the $35 per ounce at cultivation to a point of sale tax. And the point of sale tax became at the point of sale at 17% of the price, and it had different products to be taxed at that. They're all at 17% now, but if meant to be, they could change. This is not only the marijuana itself, but these are products, oils, topicals, things that are a product of legalization itself, such as cookies and Kit Kats infused and so on. These are not necessarily things that would have existed before legalization, because it wasn't necessarily something that one would buy from a person on the corner street with Kit Kats infused. So all of these things kind of became the new way of doing business, moved to the point of sale tax. And then there was also, just before that, in order to make that transition happen, the collection of taxation was given, or the authority for it, the task was given to the Department of Revenue, and the OLCC was left with the task of regulating and building and controlling that market in order to continue the life that we have between the state legalization and the federal kind of not necessarily enforcing but tolerance of the legalization. So OLCC is tasked with that. Then the Oregon Health Authority still continues to do the medical stuff, the medical marijuana. And then the Department of Agriculture, of course, does everything that has to do with agriculture and measuring and so on. So, and just before the point-of-sale taxation comes, or the commercial system comes, in January 1st, 2017. There was a one-year openness that the Joint Committee gave to the medical providers in order to provide for this year, and it was dubbed and termed as the Early Start. And the Early Start program also put a 20% increase, 25% tax on that sale versus the 17% that would be on the commercial level. So this measure basically tries to change the distribution system that we had or inherited all the way from the Measure 91. Remember, this is the 40% Common School Fund, 20, and so on. And in a very, I want to say a very high level, this is the nexus of the bill.
Thank you. I'm impressed by your intimate knowledge of this subject.
Mr. Chair, I was the resource for the Joint Committee on the taxation issue. And I think what happens after they thought, or you know, the issues are fixed and made together, the Joint Committee seems to have returned all the taxation issues and distributions and so on to the appropriate committees, your committee on the Senate side and the House Revenue Committee will be dealing with all these issues from now on. So there will be a lot more of these revenues and distributions that are coming your way. They're dealing only with fixing what needs to be fixed. The idea that they, after that fix, hopefully they will disband or go away and farm the policy to whichever policy committees needs to go to, and the taxation issue will reside with you.
Okay. Senator Burchard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mazen, I understand it then that we're at point of sale is where the taxation. So how do we handle sales outside the state?
I don't think we handle the sales outside the state. Somebody else does. And the sales outside the state, of course, Washington has its own system. Now California is developing its own system. And, of course, Alaska is on its way. And then we have few states that are becoming more with that. And just like the time post-prohibition for liquor, alcohol, when the federal government said, okay, we're not doing this, everybody on their own, I think this is exactly what's happening now. Everybody on their own, and they're kind of developing their own systems and their own type of regulations and how we do things, because there is no overarching federal national policy that deals with that. So, with different times, you would expect, some states to be more state control, more stringent on what they do, others less so, and then yet, some would have complete supply control. Others would have more of entrepreneurial type of suppliers and so on. So this is what you would expect in the coming few years if this continues to be.
So it would be advantageous if I was a grower to sell outside the state, because then I wouldn't have to pay taxes within the state.
Well, Senator Burchard, that would be true if nobody else was looking. Supposedly, we are looking. The OLCC, part of their regulation function, they've built, and they probably will inform you more about that as they do a presentation. They have this try to comply with what we call the call memo, which is from the Attorney General at the federal level, that kind of stipulates when and how the Justice Department will not follow or prosecute people for what they do. But then the OLCC have put together and working on what we call the seed-to-sale system, a very robust system where they could actually look into things, and you have, genetic DNA sequencing of which brand and so on, so we would know where it, from the point it's in the seed to the point it's at the sale. Now, not everything is perfect or 100% contained, so bad actors, people who would want to perform on the periphery of the law, they probably would find a way. However, legalization, by its essence, what it would do is, with a legal supply, you'll have more and more kind of not only pressure but disincentive for people to buy from less reputable and less regulated market. The regulated market is not necessarily competing on price, but it's competing on, let's say, quality. If you go, or if anybody goes, and buys the stuff, you would know that this stuff is being tested, for example, for pesticide, for insecticide, for things that don't necessarily others or the illegal market could claim. So once you have that, that's the high quality that comes with the legalization stuff. Also, the legalization comes security and safety of the, in addition to the safety of the product, also the security. When you go to a place where it's well lit, there is cameras, things are not necessarily dangerous to go. If my child would want to do something like that, I'd rather that they go in a safe place rather than shade the corner of some street kind of thing. So the legalization would have, with time, push the illegal market or the gray market to less and less profitable margins. And as that happens, you would find that they only are competing on the amounts that they could sell for less and less and less. And after all, people are in this illegal market in order to make money. And if the money is no longer becoming lucrative enough for the markets to do that, you would start pushing that market out. Just like we had after the prohibition, you did not, from day one or first year or first month, stop seeing moonshine or production at the home or so on. But with time, that's basically what legalization have provided, from two things, from the ability of it to be a legal market, and then also the ability of government agencies to enforce the legality of the product that is being used.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to shut up now before I get in trouble.
Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Senator Jeff Cruz, Senate District 1, along with Senator Bershiger, the epicenter of the outdoor grow environment in the state of Oregon. Just a correction, you can't get Kit Kats. So, okay, I just want to put that on the record. Well, you can, but they don't have marijuana in them. So I've been involved with this marijuana subject since 1999, when was the first year we started implementing the medical program. Senator Przanski and I have been involved in this from day one. As far as a change in the distribution, I have talked to the sponsors of the ballot measure, and they have no objection to us doing this different approach to it. What it comes down to a couple things here. Number one, as far as the black market, we're never going to touch it. Okay, we just aren't. one of our goals is to eliminate the black market in the state of Oregon. Okay, they're going to ship it, and you can get Oregon pot anywhere on the planet, and that's not going to change. And for us to assume that we're going to have an impact is an unreasonable expectation. However, as staff did say, you know, what we're going to have is a market where you have a certainty in what you're purchasing, and probably I think we can outcompete the black market price-wise, because I think they can get a lot more money someplace else than they'll be able to get in Oregon, and which is one of the reasons that we keep the cost of the system as low as possible, which is why the tax is where it is now. But we were looking, several of us, by the way, I am on that other committee, so, but it's appropriate that this issue is here with you guys. The one thing, you know, people talk about the marijuana industry being a major industry in the state of Oregon. At the point in time when the feds reschedule marijuana from a Schedule 1, that is a distinct possibility. But up until then, that is not a possibility. We already know we produce way more marijuana in this state than we can consume in the state. That's an absolute, when I say way more, maybe 10, 20 times as much as we need. That's our reality. But we can keep the price low. So the thought behind this was, because it's not a massive pot of money, but also knowing the fact that when there is a revenue source for the state of Oregon, we have a tendency to like to grow that revenue. And I didn't think that was appropriate. So what we looked at was, is there a nexus here between drugs and drug addiction and mental health issues? And there clearly is. There's no disputing that. And when you look at one of the problems we've had in the state for as long as I have been in the building is the incredibly inadequate system we have at the local level for addiction and mental health services. We all know that. Is this the silver bullet that solves that problem? No, it clearly is not. But this is another tool in the toolbox, and actually some additional revenue that could go to the local level for those services. Now, the way the bill is currently drafted is too complicated. I would suggest we take cities out. Cities are already getting a portion of the tax as it is, okay? But, you know, if we're going to have a system where we're distributing money to cities and counties and all of that, that is a heavy lift. But if we direct the money specifically to the counties, but it's focused money. It doesn't go into their general fund. It goes for the stuff the counties are already doing, which is mental health and addiction services. And we make sure that it is that they can't do anything else with it except offer those services. I think it makes a system that is workable. I'm glad this bill is in this committee, because you guys have the expertise to figure out how that would work. But you know, the bottom line is, we started out in the marijuana committee, or many of us did, to do two things. Number one was to make sure at the end of the day we have protected the medical marijuana program, because there's huge value in that. We are on a pathway in that committee where we will be able to do that. But the other part we wanted to do, because marijuana is now a legal agricultural product in the state of Oregon. You know, the voters said so, that's what it is. You know, so how do we regulate that industry relative to the way we regulate other ag industries, okay? And that's another issue outside of the purview of this committee. But quite honestly, the elimination of the black market has to do with making sure that the taxes we're imposing on this are at a low enough level so we can outcompete the black market inside the state of Oregon. And I also think that we're there's a climate change here, and the climate change is felt more at the local level than it is at the state level, as far as new things are now legal in this state. And it just makes total sense to me and several other people that this would be a very good way to spend the proceeds of this new industry, and that is to help at the community level, help our local folks deal with an issue that the state woefully underfunds, and that's mental health and drug treatment.
Senator Cruz, black market issues aside, the distribution changes that you put in your bill, I'd like to ask you about that. The original measure that voters passed put 40% to the common school fund. I think the initiative authors realized they made a mistake and meant to say school fund. But nonetheless, voters, you would presume, thought that the proceeds from this would be going to schools. So under this bill and other plans I've seen, that takes that away and distributes it to local cities and counties for mental health. And I'm not saying that's a terrible idea, but in some ways it is kind of thumbing our nose to the voters who thought that the 40% at least would go to education.
Mr. Chair, and all due respect, I would submit to you that the majority of the people that voted for the ballot measure were voting to legalize marijuana.
You know that?
I do not know that. But I do know that the people who brought the ballot measure, I don't think put an incredible amount of thought into where the money should go. And I know that they are supportive of this model of redistribution. And at this point in time, we aren't talking, you know, this isn't going to save K-12 one way or the other. We know that. What I'm looking at, Mr. Chair, is because this is a relatively small amount of money compared to a lot of other things we do here. And what I'm looking at is the impact this small amount of money would have on local service delivery in those two specific areas. It would have a much bigger impact than it going into the common school fund or whatever you think it should go there. And I would also suggest, Mr. Chair, that we do have some mental health issues in our schools as well. So there is a nexus there that we have the services available for for the juvenile mental health issues, because there's a lot of places in the state those services are not available. And so there is a benefit that would accrue to schools as well.
Senator Burchard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Cruz, I appreciate you bringing this forward. I don't know. I think it needs a little work. I'm desperately worried about my district, especially Josephine County part of it. We have very little law enforcement, and just this week, the sheriff just sent out another 47 layoff notices to officers. So we are a county that grows a significant amount of marijuana, and we virtually don't have any law enforcement in that. And we all know it's some property tax reasons, but that's a twofold part. One is we don't have much land. We don't have much tax base. You know, I keep getting criticism that we need to raise the taxes, but when you do the numbers, even if we raise the taxes, we don't have that much property. 78% of the property in that county is federally owned or state owned, and we don't receive a nickel from it. So we have no tax base. So if we could work into this bill to put some money towards law enforcement to regulation, that would be greatly appreciated.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bershiger, that was part of the proposal as well. Now, keep in mind that the cities are getting 8%, and at this point, that's not designated for anything except whatever they want to use it for. I would not be object at all to a portion of this being designated for law enforcement as well. And I know what you're talking about. One of my counties, Curry County, has about the same percent of the land that is federally owned as well. And on top of that, Curry County has the highest percent of retired people of any county in the state. So, you know, to try to raise property taxes on people with fixed incomes is not necessarily a really good idea, which, and they have failed every time they have attempted it. So we do have some financial crises in a lot of counties, but that also speaks to the need for this money. It's not just law enforcement, but it's these other services that these counties are woefully inadequate in being able to provide.
Other questions? Okay, thank you, Senator.
Thank you.
Steve, Marks, do you have a team that you want to come up?
Mr. Chair, we tried to put the
thank you
group of presentations for you.
Okay.
And that we thought the Department of Revenue could come first and give you an idea about the collection and the revenue and so on. Then we'll bring up Mr. Marks and his team from OLCC,
yeah.
And then at the end bring DCBS to be able to give you also an issue with the banking issues that we have a problem with.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Deanna Mack, Department of Revenue. And I think the public hearing is still open on 8:45, so if I could testify to that. Whatever distribution you guys decide on doing, we just want to make sure that the effective date is, right now this bill has a 91st day after sine die, which would mean that the existing distributions are still in place for possibly up to 90 days, depending on when you adjourn. So just as whatever you do, however you decide to distribute the money, just can you be mindful of the distribution of the effective dates of the bills so that we don't have two different sets of formulas that we have to try and implement on either short notice or
what could we do? We could do retroactive dates on this.
We can, Mr. Chair. I think one of the issues that are with the distributions came as also a result of some of the work that was done in 2015, which said it gave two things. It gave the ability for cities and counties to opt out, and then it said if you opt out, you don't get distributions. However, that happens only in the second year, not the first year. So I think one of the issues that created is, okay, we divide and distribute money in the first year according to one formula, and then the second year on, we are going to distribute according to a second formula that does not include the opted out localities, because the Joint Committee said if you opt out, you don't get any money. So I think we could actually come back and say that we could fix this. Now, your counterparts on the House side are also working with some of these formulas to fix these things. So we probably both come up with these fixes with time.
Okay.
Question.
Senator Bircher.
Now that we have a new administration, has there been any questions asked of the Revenue Department on this issue and how Oregon collects this money from the new federal administration?
Mr. Chair and Senator Bartsugar, I believe that TIDCA, the taxpayer, I don't remember what it stands for, has been to the department and asking information about how we collect cash and distribute.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. So do you want me to do the presentation now?
Please.
Okay.
Sorry, I got us out of order. Cause
sorry. Okay. okay. So first, I have three pieces of information in OLIS for you, and I'm going to jump away from my presentation first, and I'm going to ask you to look to the document that is, actually, I'm not sure what it's named in there, but it's Oregon Marijuana Tax Statistical Report. It's a report that we published in quarter one, and it has a really nice timeline in the document on page three about how marijuana was implemented in Oregon, just at a really high level, the different bill numbers that are in there for you to refer to. So I think, like Mazin said, that marijuana was voted in November, passed in November of 2014, Measure 91. July 1 of 2015, people were allowed to possess marijuana, but there was no taxation component yet. And then October 1, 2015, is when we had what is called early start provisions. So the early start provisions were recreational sales through medical dispensaries. There was no tax on the sales from November, from October 1st until January 3rd, 2016, and that was because Measure 91 wasn't effective. The tax wasn't effective until January 4th, is my understanding, 2016. So the early start tax was 25% tax rate. There was no local tax, and it was also collected at the point of sale, like Mazen explained. There was the businesses that do this for us, that collect the tax at the point of sale, you're paying them to do that. They get to retain 2% of their of the tax they collect to offset their administrative costs. So they remit net to us. Recreational stores started in, those are licensed through OLCC. They started in the fall of 2016 going forward, and the rate dropped from 25%, excuse me, to 17% with the local tax of up to 3%. The retail recreational sales in OLCC licensed stores are through the cannabis tracking system, the seed to sale tracking system. That's part of I think we, some of the questions earlier alluded to the guidance that was provided in the Cole memorandum. There's eight priorities. And I'll go over them really high level. There's preventing distribution to minors. This is to avoid getting in trouble with the federal government. Prevent marijuana revenues from funding any criminal activities. Prevent diversion out of state to other states. Prevent use of state legal marijuana as a cover for illegal activity. Prevents violence and use of firearms in the cultivation and growing of marijuana. Prevents DUII, intoxicated driving, or other adverse public health issues. They don't want you to be growing any marijuana on public lands and being mindful of public safety and environmental issues, as well as preventing marijuana possession or use on federal property. So those are the eight guidelines in which the legislation was crafted and made. So part of that is to track it closely, and that is where we have the seed to sale tracking system. So one thing I did forget to say is that medical marijuana card holders can purchase tax-free in retail stores. So in Senate Bill 1511, you guys expanded the early start sales to allow edibles, non-psychoactive topicals, and receptacles, which are the vape pens or butane hash oil, that kind of thing. Those sales began June 2nd, 2016. And they were added to the early start tax return. Remember, those are through the medical dispensaries. They're not the licensed retailers, so that's the early start. As far as administering the tax, we decided to model this because this is a trust fund. It is collected, it is a tax owed by the consumer, collected by the retailer or the dispensary and submitted to us. It's a trust fund, and so we modeled it after our withholding tax program. So these folks have to make deposits monthly, and they have to file a quarterly return to reconcile those monthly payments. Right now, that we're just in the retail market now, they have to file their returns online. That's their only option, is online only. And those are for all the retailers licensed by OLCC. Under the dispensary model, under Early Start, they were able to file paper returns, but there was quite a bit less tracking involved with that. I'm not going to go too much over the banking issues since you have DCBS here to talk about those for you today, but it is a cash-intensive business, so that's where I'm going to talk about it for Department of Revenue. Like Mazen said, we found out in May of 2015 that we would be implementing this, and sales started in October of 2015, so we had to very quickly figure out a way to get a secure place in our building to handle the volume of cash. So we met with folks from Washington and Colorado. We went and toured their facilities to identify what their experiences were. Thankfully, we were not first. We learned a lot from both and how to implement. We do have a plan for, because of the issue with the federal issue that they're going to be talking about, we do have a long-term plan to deal with high volumes of cash. At least 10 years is what our plan is. We have a secure facility in our building where folks make deposits. We have them schedule appointments with us depending on the amount of time it takes us to count the cash, we will schedule an appointment for that time window. We have to know they're coming. We have taken quite a few steps to make sure that staff and taxpayers feel safe in the building and around the building. And then we have staffing. We had to deal with staffing coverage for internal controls. So every time that someone is making a cash deposit, we have to have two people counting it, and then those people cannot also be the same people that reconcile it on the back end for internal control purposes. So I did mention this, that we are expecting the federal government to not take any action anytime soon, although our Oregon delegation has recently put forward a plan that might help some of us here in Oregon. We are still planning that it's going to take, even if it does pass tomorrow, it's going to take 10 years for regulations to come into place. So we definitely have a plan for the long-term use of this issue. We do have the secure facility. We are asking to expand it to include our other tax programs. So that is something that will be on be presenting in the Ways and Means side of the building, I believe. One thing that I want you to be mindful of is that this isn't just an issue for marijuana retailers. This is an issue for peripheral businesses as well. Anyone who is using, who's doing business with in this world is, you know, your attorney or your accountant or other people are still, they have these issues as well with banking. So just really high level, the receipts you can see from early start, that's the 2016 numbers. We had almost $21 million through June 30th of 2016 from early start sales. And then the next slide, it continues with early start sales to the program, what we have completely through February 28th of 2017, which is the most recent month. The February receipts represent the January tax. So the tax, like I said earlier, they have to remit monthly. So they collect the tax in January from the consumers and they remit it to us by the end of the following month. So the February receipts are from January sales. So far we have almost $70 million. We have been having some issues with some folks. This is a new tax program. They don't understand sometimes that they need to file returns as well as just make those deposits. The information that is on the return, especially now that we're collecting for the local governments, break it down for us to tell us how much money goes to which area. So we've had to do some filing enforcement because they just don't understand the returns are required to be filed as well. We're doing that, and people are getting better and better compliance as time goes on. It's just a learning curve, I think. We have done an amazing amount of outreach with our partner agencies. OLCC has been instrumental. Our Treasury Department has been instrumental in getting information out to these folks. We have a lot of information provided, and we have dedicated phone lines, that kind of thing for folks. I'm going to skip a couple of slides. So one of the things that we have asked us to do is administer the tax and collect the tax for local governments. We worked with the stakeholders, the League of Oregon Cities, Wendy Johnson, and others to create a uniform interagency governmental agreement or intergovernmental agreement for us to administer as streamlined as possible the work that we do currently for the income tax programs in the same way that we would do it for the locals. And we've got over 70 IGAs that we have completed that we're administering now out of, I believe, just under 100, I think 95 to 100. So a good portion of them we're administering now. And as you've been recently talking, the current distribution formula is stated here on this slide. And the issue with it is the way that the statute was structured originally. The OLCC and OHA OLCC was able to borrow from the liquor fund for startup costs. And we have to distribute after we pay back the liquor fund. And so the way that the statute is currently structured is there's this pre-January 1, 2017 distribution formula, and then there's a July 1, 2017 and later distribution formula. because the OLCC can continue to spend until June 30th of 2017, we won't be able to make that repayment until after the secondary distribution formula comes into place. And that's why there's so many, so much conversation about where this should go. Right now, we're not estimating that we will be able to make any distributions until sometime in August, maybe even early September, once we reconcile all of the loans and the paybacks and send things back. Does that make sense? Okay. So we are working with OLCC. We're working with the partners on how to get the distribution formulas in place. It's obviously, it's a concern for us. We can distribute wherever you want us to do it. We just need to have the time to be able to do it and the information in order to do it properly. So we've had to put a number of rules in place about, and these are just listed here so you know what folks are doing relating to the tax system and the due dates, the how they file with us. You gave us quite a bit of rulemaking authority, which is here on those slides. And then this is just a cheat sheet for who is, which agency is responsible for which part of the program and their contact information. So that's all I have. I just wanted to give you a quick overview of how we got where we are and the different timeline components. So this document here on OLIS is really helpful. It has a lot of really good high-level information for you
to follow the pun. Chronology there. Thank you.
The chronology, yeah.
Yeah, thanks for putting that together, and thanks for this overview. Any questions for Revenue? Senator Burchard?
So still today, if somebody has a business in Medford, they have to drive to Salem to make their deposit.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bartsugar, yes, that is correct right now. That is correct.
What is the most money they can deposit? What's your limit? I see you had a limit.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bartsugar, I don't know that there's a set limit. Like, there's a limit based on amount of time it takes to count?
Add up there that there's a maximum amount they can deposit, some one of those slides. I don't know.
Hmm.
Dollar limit on deposits.
Yeah, that's some of the other states have chosen to do that. Like, I think that there are some that said $10,000 increments. We chose not to do that. Those are factors that we considered when we were implementing.
Okay, thank you very mm-hmm. much. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Anything okay. Thank you, Deanna. Do we want to bring up the DCBS team?
Mr. Chair, would like to bring the OLCC team.
The OLCC team, okay.
Because they would give you an idea about the regulation work, regulation functions, how they've been implementing all the new laws that you've asked them to do. And then DCBS would talk to you about the banking issue, all this cash all right. problem, and what we... They've done a lot of work with that.
After. So we're still kind of in background mode here before we get to distribution.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Steve Marks, Executive Director of OLCC. So we're going to give you a snapshot background of the work OLCC has been doing over the past couple of years. It's been challenging work. It's been really... all hands on deck for the agency in terms of putting out the numbers of licenses that the system has required us to do. And you'll see from the presentation, we've had about double the demand on those licenses as what we were budgeted for and expected. We're entering a new period in our regulatory environment where we are now moving people who had been working on licensing back and towards enforcement, both in alcohol and marijuana, where they're dedicated. So we have some challenges going forward with licensing. We just had a very interesting discussion with the Subcommittee of Ways and Means on our budget about this, and so they've been very receptive, I think, and understanding of the situation we face in getting this whole industry licensed under Oregon law. The things that we do licensing, we do worker permit processing, and Bill will later, Bill Schutte, our economist, will go through and you'll see some of the numbers associated with this soon. We analyzed the cannabis tracking system. We actually had to create that system and our online licensing system last year. The cannabis tracking system is integral to doing what we do, which is to prevent inversion and diversion to the black market from our legal system. That's our responsibility, is to ensure that our system doesn't leak marijuana into the black market. And we do that by the cannabis tracking system. We do that by the security requirements that we have of our licensees, cameras, backup tapes, alarms, lockup of the marijuana on site. And then we do that with field enforcement and follow-up. We have taken a very strong approach. It has been a very helpful approach on education as the greatest way to gain compliance. It's actually worked tremendously well for us, so we put out a lot of information and do try to assist the industry in meeting our requirements of tracking on a daily basis. We've had a lot of vendors. Those are both associated with our IT systems for cannabis tracking and for the online licensing system for marijuana. A tremendous amount of coordination with local government. Not only does our system preclude us from going forward the way it's established with licenses that do not meet the local land use requirements, so we will not process a license if they do not have a LUX or that condition satisfied before we move forward.
Senator Taylor.
Thank you, Chair Hess. I was just curious about looking through your slide here. What systems are in place in order to prevent someone from mailing marijuana to other parts of the country or overseas?
So the cannabis tracking system that we have actually provides weights and packages for every part of the marijuana that is in our system. So we tag the plants. So if you mail out significant quantities, we'll know that those packages do not exist, those weights, those measures do not exist as we track the plant and packages from seed to sale. Now, I'm not saying that our system alone would be 100% effective. That's why we have the cameras, and that's why we have field enforcement to follow up on that. But it's certainly possible, and from testimony in the Joint Committee, we know packages get mailed around the United States.
Follow-up. Thank you, Chair Hess. So how, I'm just, obviously one of the objectives of allowing marijuana to be grown and sold is in order to collect the revenue, obviously. And so it's concerning that, not that you're not working hard on this issue, but that marijuana is obviously being sold and we're not collecting the revenue. And so is there, are you in discussions with the United States Postal Service or UPS or FedEx or any of these other entities in order to try to come up with a way to prevent this from happening, or I'm just curious.
Chairman Hass, Senator Taylor, we haven't had direct conversations, but you know the Postal Service has been after this for years, and federal policy definitely outlaws the mailing of this illegal substance. So, yeah, we haven't had those conversations. We've had a lot on our plate.
Thank you.
So a lot of coordination with local government. I just add that we've sort of become a clearinghouse for all problems marijuana or grows. Medical marijuana grows look like our grows. Illegal grows look like our grows. Hemp often looks like our grows, although the plants are a little scrawnier and the fields are larger with hemp grows, quite frankly. They're regulated by the Department of Agriculture. So we've become a clearinghouse for all of the complaints about whose grows are where. We can tell people who our licensees are. We do a tremendous amount of coordination with local government and with local law enforcement on these issues, and we've received a lot of comments from local government and local law officials on the need for coordination. You know, there are issues in these grows between neighbors and land use issues. As we know, our system is inherently compliant with land use because we don't move forward with applications unless they meet the established land use requirements. We have an extensive packaging and labeling pre-approval process, actually. We look at the art, the color, the type of packaging that's going to be put together for the marijuana product. We ensure and pre-approve that all of the existing information that is required to be on the label about the testing itself and about the warning labels and all that, the warnings that we put on are all in the properly affixed. We require that all packaged goods go out in child-resistant packaging. Some of those packages are third-party certified packages. We also require that the edibles go out in resealable child-resistant packaging so that they take manipulation of two thumbs or more activity to actually open the package. And with that, I'd just say a couple things. We've signed with MAPS and a bill passed now Treasurer Reed, then Rep. Reed forwarded last year in the House. Came through here, allowed us to share our cannabis tracking system data with financial institutions so that they could do regulatory compliance. We now have a signed agreement with MAPS Credit Union. We're providing them the data. It's voluntarily allowed by the licensee that they would get to that data. We share it. We now have an agreement to share it, and that's so that MAPS can meet the suspicious activity requirements that they're required to meet. So it's been an aid. I'd say just to cover a bit of banking while we're here, Washington, who has state-chartered banking system, seems to have had more success with getting some accounts into their local banking system. Vital service for preventing violence on the sites. The cash is a major issue, but it's a vital, necessary service for this young business. All these new businesses out there need regular Oregon business services. You know, they need liability insurance. They need other products that the marketplace has found difficulty delivering to them. And so we've worked with other state agencies on doing a business readiness guide to help stabilize this industry that we've been called on to license here. So with that, I'll turn it over to Bill to go through some of the metrics that we've put together for you.
Committee Chair, for the record, Bill Schutte, economist with the Liquor Control Commission. In addition to what the duties Mr. Marks just described, we also do the basic, as we do for alcohol, licensing, approval. There are required marijuana worker permits, similar to alcohol server permits, but more extensive through the industry. We're required to issue those. Those are generally an education component with the background check, registration in the system. We investigate citizen complaints, work with licensees to achieve compliance, and starting to issue violations and assist in preparing representing cases at administrative hearings. So with that, I'll get into some of the numbers. To date, we probably issued over 1,100 licenses now. That's the first column of this. The great majority of those are producer licenses or grower licenses. The next column, however, is the work yet to be done. So even though we've issued over almost 1,100 licenses, we have over 1,200 applications that have yet to be investigated. The number of applications that have come into the system have been about double than what we were expected. And that's what the third column is. We were expecting about 1,000 applications, issuing 800 licenses, 850 licenses plus. We have issued those plus some more. Right now, the application trend continues to go up. You'll see a graphic of that on the next slide. And for the next biennium, we're expecting maybe close to almost 2,000 licenses in the next biennium. Here's a location of where the licenses have been issued. A large concentration of Portland metro area through the I-5 corridor, and of course Southern Oregon, where most of the larger grow operations are at. You also see a big blank spot in Eastern Oregon, where most of the counties and cities have opted out. So this is the application gap that we're facing. So the dark bars are the cumulative number of licenses we've issued through February. The red line on top of that was the original application forecast, and the black line on top of that is the actual number of applications we received. We're at a point in our compliance program where we're having to shift regulatory specialists, the primary ones that were doing a license investigation, into compliance. And at this point, with the increased applications, we're seeing a potential gap of over 1,200 licenses through the ongoing biennium. And as Mr. Marks alluded to, we are requesting resources to add more people to investigate those licenses. So it is an issue, and we're trying to address it as best as we can at this point through the budget process. The marijuana license fee revenue, this is a fee-funded program, so we set fee levels to fund the program. The average marijuana licensing fee is about $5,000 with the application fee. As you can see, most of the revenue comes from the producer licenses with processors, wholesalers, and retailers, laboratories. We also collect fees for packaging, compliance, or approvals. The GRB forecast, the governor's recommended budget, was originally $11 million, but we could probably update that forecast almost monthly based on the continued number of applications that can come into the system. Right now, for the GRB, we're forecasting $17 million, hoping to use that additional revenue to fund positions to do the license investigation and close the gap that I just talked about before. Oregon marijuana sales have been brisk, I think was the word I used before. These are the actual sales from the early start. The orange bars are the early start sales. The blue bars are where the OLC system started up. Of course, as of January 1st, early start ended. I can tell you that for the March sales so far, we're probably looking at a record number of almost $34 million in sales. So that was higher, the highest bar that we've seen so far. In addition to the $34 million, about 14% of the total sales are medical sales. So we're seeing about $6 million in medical sales in each of the dispensaries. As Deanna mentioned, medical sales are non-taxable. There has been a dramatic decline in the number of actual medical dispensaries, so we're seeing more medical patients coming into the retail outlets to purchase their medical marijuana. And just as a point of interest from an economic standpoint, the top blue line are the average monthly sales from the state of Washington. And so we're always interested in trying to forecast and our dips or is there a decline in the market coming? But according to looking at the Washington data, there appears to be some seasonality in sales like we do see in liquor. August, September seems to be a high point. This is in our mature market. Then the sales tend to go down in the winter, which is actually the opposite for what happens with liquor sales. And then they come back up again in the spring. And then this is a breakdown of product that is sold. 71% of what they call musable marijuana or the flower, about 20% are the concentrates, so the oils and the extracts that go into like vape pens and edibles, and then 7% in edibles, and then other topicals, smaller percentages. Each one of these, by the way, does have a tax category. They're all being taxed at 17%, but there's an opportunity to change the tax rates on any of these product categories if decision is made to do that.
Just some of these numbers, just so you understand, our licensing system is an all-comers licensing system, right? It's qualifications-based. We do have criminal background checks and other things, but if you meet our requirements, right, you get licenses and you can hold multiple license types. So, you know, that's why you see these exploding numbers on us. There are no limits. We limit the canopy size of the grows, so the grows can only be of a certain size, and that was by design. I think the joint committee was interested in a distributed industry initially. So that's some of the reasons why you're looking at the kind of numbers that we're looking at with licensing. We do believe, even in our regulated legal market, there will be a shakeout. At some point, we'll oversaturate, licensees in that market, and then we'll start seeing business failures. So that's going to be a particular point of emphasis for us on enforcement, because at that point, the temptation for diversion is going to be very high. We have extensive testing requirements.
Yeah, before we go on much farther, let's go back to the canopy. So what is the current rule right now on canopy for a tax lot?
Bill can help me out. Outdoor, our largest one's just under an acre, and then we're about a half acre. And the equivalent indoor is 4 to 1. So yes. I can't remember the square footage that comes to, but it's, you know, 4 times smaller because we were called on in statute to sort of make indoor and outdoor equivalent. So we put in place a ratio that says, you know, one outdoor grow or one indoor grow probably gets 3 or 4 cuts off of it. So that's equivalent to the larger, you know, under half acre size. Sorry, we can get you those square footage.
1 acre per tax lot, 40,000 square feet.
Yeah.
Like
little less than
so
acre.
The maximum grow tier, and then there are smaller grow tiers under that. So there are 4 separate grow tier licenses, and the largest one is 40,000 square feet.
So one license owner, though, can have multiple tax lots. So you could have one owner could have 100 acres, theoretically.
So one owner on their contiguous property, and I won't be precise here because legally it gets nebulous, but if you have a border property you own, essentially, you get, as a licensee, you get one application and one grow. Now, you could have on that land another independent business operation also licensed with a canopy. So you could have multiple grows on the 100 acres or larger properties.
Not long as you have different tax lots. It's tied to tax lots, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
We have extensive testing in the Oregon system. So part of what Senator Cruz was talking about, those differences in quality control are definitely there. I do see a big part of our operation, our legal system, as being a consumer protection function. You know, because of the tracking system, we can recall tainted product. And we have a significant testing in Oregon, more than anywhere in the nation right now. We test down to batch sizes that are off a harvest lot of 10 pounds, generally for flour. Currently in OLCC, we've relaxed those rules. We're essentially testing, we're testing 33% of the initial requirement, which means we're essentially testing 30-pound batch size. Currently, we have the ability to change that. There is a lot of discussion in the emerging industry about whether the testing is excessive. And it's also difficult to understand what you're preventing in terms of health effects because there isn't a lot of reliable science to say what the health effects are. So the standards in Oregon are primarily calibrated on the measurements that machines can detect. We have had a certification process on all of the labs in Oregon. That's carried out by OHA. They certify the labs. We do license the labs. But there will be still significant amount of discussion and rulemaking around the testing requirements for cannabis. But I think that the fact that we lead the country is a testament to the system that Oregon has put together, and there's a lot of sentiment that those systems need to be relaxed a bit, but not be let go of, certainly. In terms of compliance, I briefly talked about that initially, and I just will again here. We have the cannabis tracking system, and it's certainly reinforced by our rules and by field enforcement, which we need to prioritize currently. We carry out all the sanctions and the administrative law process through the agency. So once we do have violations in our system, we follow up with those and argue them with the administrative law judges. A lot of enforcement coordination, and as you can imagine, this is a substance. It's not legal federally. It's confusingly regulated by state law, not just us, but by multiple state laws, makes it very difficult sometimes in the field where we don't have a blueprint or protocols for how our system interfaces with law enforcement and the legal system. We've had outstanding cooperation every time we've needed to work with law enforcement. On the other hand, I would say currently law enforcement's general status is that marijuana is not of their highest priority. and understandably so when you have other difficulties and shortages of law enforcement's rural counties and otherwise where other kinds of criminal activity get prioritized. That makes it challenging. That also means that a lot of times we have product that's sort of stranded from the criminal system and maybe have difficulties in ours. So we're working to bridge that gap, and we default to bring product into our system instead of letting it go to the black market when we're confronted with those choices. Not always possible to do, but we've made those choices when we've had the opportunity. But also, we do have the opportunity if we control the product on our license, and it's something that our licensee did, we can always potentially destroy the product if it's illegal. But it's challenging. We've had, between the kinds of approaches we've taken, some of the activity with our licensees is illegal or we think is illegal. That takes a different kind of warrant and investigation and cooperation from local law enforcement. They can't just march out there with us. We have administrative oversight to be on the property and do our work. But it's been a tricky part of the business. I have to say we have not certified a diversion. We do have a couple of notable cases that are complete failures within the system, and we're in the process of sanctioning them and working through removals of those licenses. Licensing has been a lot of work. You can see it just doubled up. I won't belabor that any more than you've talked about. I will say that you've seen that we're self-financed through our fees. We have, and the governor's budget and working with legislative fiscal are coming together to recognize that our revenue is going up. So we need the FTE to support that, and really, we may have to borrow again from the liquor fund to front the work to add licensing staff, because that'll generate the revenue inside our agency that then we'll be able to fund and make sure that we have the funding in place for the increased enforcement presence that we plan to build. That growth is almost a doubling of our personnel in this time, so we'll be looking to do that and are working both with the governor's office and with the legislature on accomplishing that. But it's important that even to the extent that we may have some on our major license type moderate fee increases that we may be asking for. But I think it's important to your work here, because I think our job is to, in part, help you figure out where this new industry is going to stabilize at and how we're going to put it together and what its ultimate numbers are, and what kinds of predictable revenue are going to be in place from it eventually as the revenue committee with that charge. And that was resource constraints. So with that, I'll conclude our testimony.
Well, thanks for that, Dr. Any questions in the ULCC? Senator Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So we've talked a lot about revenue, but I haven't heard anything about expenses, and I'm curious how those match up.
So, Chair Hass, Senator Riley. So, I don't have, but legislative fiscal is working for all of the expenses of the state against the revenue, the $70 million or more that's coming. What I can say, our system is self-financed by fees on the industry. So we're totally self-contained in that. None of that, they finance the entirety of our program currently. You saw we went from about $10 million, and with new revenues, or if we get licensed the additional $1,200, we'll be at about $17 million, all self-funded and self-executed.
So none of the tax goes to support your...
We receive no tax dollars.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Hass. However, I would like to mention, you bring up, I think, an interesting point, Senator Riley, because I also serve on the Ways and Means Subcommittee on Natural Resources, and we know from hearing the Department of Agricultural budget there that they are struggling and are needing additional revenue in order to pay for the testing and, the inspection program. And I know it's been very, very difficult on the employees of that department and for that program, because they've had to, unfortunately, there's been in the testing, they've had quite a few growers who have not met the criteria, and that causes all sorts of complications. And so I don't want to speak for them, and someone can look into it, but I think that they're asking something like $1 million or something. It's a significant amount of money that they need for to cover that cost. So I don't know how it's being presented, but I think that we probably would be a good idea to talk about the whole picture of everyone who's involved in enforcement of the marijuana industry. But
Chairman Hass, Senator Taylor, and maybe it's not my place, but I can't resist. So,
maybe I got that wrong, though, too.
Yeah,
it's okay. There's a lot of that around here.
Yeah, Department of Agriculture definitely has costs that are being not funded. They've had a lot of demand. They've been a great partner for us, you know, and as is our, you know, we have intergovernmental relationships between us and revenue and OHA and ODA, which I'd say are the sort of the primary players. There are some other state government players beyond that. And the pots of money you got, we are financed off of, you know, the fees on the industry. In the medical side, they do have the cardholder fees, which is potential funding. And then you have the tax dollars. And I'll just say that, you know, the model that we have at OLCC on liquor is you have the administrative fund and you take care of those costs. On the alcohol side, we take care of our costs, you know, compensation of our agents, credit card fees, all of the staff, and then we put that money in through the distribution that remains.
Mm-hmm. And Co-Chair Senator Taylor, I think I would also mention that in our current governor's recommended budget, we are allocating or moving over about almost $300,000 to the Department of Agriculture to fund at least the one current position they have as their marijuana coordinator that was set up originally in the original budget, and it's going to continue that way. So there is some fee funding moving into the Department of Agriculture, but not to the need you just expressed. So.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, the costs at one point, we knew the system is set up, cost would be significant because this is a new system. We don't have anything set up in place. I think the original estimate for all these things to put together was about $20 million a biennium, or this biennium, in order to set up the cost. From that point on, expectation is about $3.5 to $4 million. However, a lot of that, I think, what it came out to be is a lot of that is financed by fees, about half of it. So in essence, about 10, 12 million only would be taken out of the tax revenue, and the rest of it is collected by fees.
Okay, gentlemen, thank you.
I appreciate your help here. In time remaining, like call up DCBS and their team.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Committee members, for the record, I'm Rick Blackwell. I'm the policy manager for the Division of Financial Regulation, part of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. So I know we're not in front of this committee very often, but among other things, we regulate financial institutions, so banks and credit unions. We also do some non-depository institutions, so money transmitters. All that will come into play as we go on. So I guess the third part of the conversation is, now that we have significant amounts of cash in this that have been generated based on sales, how does the tax money get from these businesses to the Department of Revenue? I mean, this really does require the modern banking system. The vast majority of legitimate businesses get to transmit money electronically, but we have challenges and federal issues that we're trying to work through as well. So, but this was on everyone's minds in 2016. So the legislature, led by then Representative Reed, had enacted House Bill 4094. And so that bill really did three things. First, exempted financial institutions from certain state criminal laws. So there's some state laws related to, I think, state laws that would have bear on the ability of banks to accept marijuana deposits. Those were repealed from Oregon law, but not from federal law, of course. The second part was enabling greater information sharing between OLCC and the Oregon Health Authority and Revenue with the institutions themselves. because there's not a actually a blanket prohibition on accepting deposits, but there is some there's a lot of due diligence that has to happen in order for deposits to be accepted. Information sharing is certainly a very important part of making sure that the institutions are able to do their diligence. And then finally, which is what we're here to talk about today, the department was to study and identify actions that we could take either legislatively or administratively to facilitate the depositing of money in state-chartered financial institutions. So, again, banks and credit unions. The bill was also amended to include essentially money transmitters. So there are some entities that do, especially one in Washington State, that does attempt to move money from business to other locations, but does need a banking relationship in order to do that. So what we did was we convened a series of work groups through the interim. So we had folks from the banking community, banks and credit unions, so insurance also, because deposit insurance is certainly something that needs to be considered when you're dealing with institutions that need to be insured in order to stay around. We had some cannabis consultants that had been working with institutions to make sure that they're doing their diligence. The OLCC, State Treasury, the Department of Justice, and then finally Department of Revenue. So we met a couple times during the interim, once before the presidential election and once after the presidential election, and just really worked one-on-one with those folks and then in a collective manner to try to figure out what can we do. And so I think at this point what I'll do is I'll turn it over to Aaron Tieverbaugh, who is our senior policy analyst and the author of the report.
Good morning, Chair, members of the committee. My name is Aaron Tieverbaugh. I'm a senior policy analyst for the Division of Financial Regulation. The group essentially broke it down to a couple of different recommendations or things that could be done. First and foremost, it was recognized as a federal issue. It's the treatment of marijuana under federal law that largely causes any of the issues with regard to banking, the credit unions, the money transmitters. And in order to address that, what the committee suggested is that we need a coalition of the states to represent at the federal level. So currently, 28 states and the Washington, D.C. all have legalized marijuana in some form. And so there is a considerable number of the congressional coalition or the congressional body at the federal level that is impacted by the treatment of marijuana at the federal level. So if all of the states that had these sorts of issues could get together and present bills or advocate for changes to either the scheduling of marijuana or the how banking is addressed, there's also tax issues, then that would provide some sort of momentum, hopefully, for changing it and making it easier on the 28 states that do have lifted the prohibition. In addition to that, the committee also suggested, or the work group also suggested that the general executives from the various states that have legalized recreational marijuana, they also needed to exert some sort of pressure or, at the very least, speak up and say, we as the state have this issue, this is an increasing issue, and something needs to be done about it. And so there is some momentum there. The second recommendation is, failing any sort of movement at the federal level, would be the state regulators and really open communication with the state regulators, guidance, outreach, how it is that the financial institutions can serve the industries, because there has been federal guidance that says, yes, you can do this. And so it would be it would behoove the state regulators to be able to do the outreach and say, all right, we have the guidance that says, yes, you can do this. How can we all work together to make sure that it gets done? Or at the very least, answer questions and make sure that there aren't impediments at the state level, specifically at the state level. There also needs to be some sort of guidance with regard to secondary accounts. So the guidance at the federal level has specifically addressed the plant facing, plant touching businesses and whether or not you can accept those accounts. There hasn't actually been any guidance at the federal level with regard to secondary accounts, which would be state taxes or lawyers who are helping out businesses or accountants who are helping out businesses or people who are selling fertilizers or grow lamps or things like that that don't necessarily touch the plant, and the activities themselves aren't necessarily sanctionable at the federal level, but because of the interaction with the cannabis, that causes a problem. And so some sort of guidance with regard to how is it that financial institutions treat secondary accounts, how do we remain compliant with the federal laws in that regard, would also go a long way to making sure that there is some sort of access to financial institutions. Recently, there has been some activity at the federal level. In December of 2016, there was a letter from 10 different senators, states that have recreational and medicinal marijuana, asking specifically for guidance with regard to the secondary accounts. On March 30th, at the federal level, there's a cannabis coalition. It's fairly small still, and it's made up of senators and representatives from the various states who have recreational programs. They submitted three bills to the Senate and four in the House that would address the taxation issues, address the scheduling issues. One of them is really similar to the treat alcohol or marijuana like alcohol that was introduced previous session. So there is some movement at the federal level with the states that do have this issue pushing forward. And then yesterday, the governors of Oregon, Alaska, Colorado, and Washington sent a letter both to the Treasury Secretary and to Mr. Sessions, Attorney General Sessions, requesting that at the very least the previous guidance under the previous administrations remain where it is so that there isn't more confusion and that the current status quo at the very least isn't thrown into disarray. So there has been some movement at the federal levels with regard both to the state delegations and to the state executives.
So
question.
Oh, Trigger.
Thank you. Yeah, you guys kind of went a long way around the barn. At the end of the day, I want to know, how is it the state of Oregon can receive money from the production of marijuana?
Mr. Chair and Senator Beartrigger. So at this point, as long as if an institution is completing its due diligence, it's doing everything that it can, it's getting information from folks, OLCC, Revenue, and OHA, and is open to actually banking deposits. I mean, you know, this is actually also an issue where we can only ask banks at best we could ask banks to bank these proceeds in order to get them into the banking system. It's not one for which, you know, as a regulator that's concerned with safety and soundness of the institutions, we can't compel them to take deposits. So I guess going back around the barn, either it's done through the actions that the revenue has taken, or a willing banking partner would actually be able to take those deposits, presuming they've done all their work. We are dealing with significant federal uncertainty as well. I mean, I think we're all in the same boat. I don't think
going back to my original question.
Yes, though.
How is the state of Oregon able to receive money from the production of marijuana?
So it either Chair Hast and Senator Beartrigger, again, it's going to go through either those institutions that are doing their diligence and transmitting the money through the means that they do for every other legitimate business, or it's going to be done through more extraordinary measures that revenue is set up.
If I may, Chair Hast, Senator Beartrigger, currently, while a lot of the large national banks have said that they don't or won't accept deposits, they actually are and do accepting deposits. So with the federal guidance that's out there, what the Department of Treasury has said, and FinCEN, which is the research and enforcement arm, is you can do this, but you need to make sure that you have enhanced due diligence, that you're not implicating any of the Cole memos, which means you can accept these deposits, but you need to make sure that it's not going across state lines. You're not selling to minors. It's not being involved with gang violence. It doesn't implicate firearms and weapons and those sorts of things. So if you can track it, if you are working within a licensed structure, and if you submit what they have created is a marijuana specific, it's a marijuana limited suspicious activity report, because it still remains an activity that needs to be reported at the federal level, but they have streamlined it so that there's this marijuana limited SARS that allows financial institutions of any size, so long as they've got the compliance mechanisms internally and the approval of their board, to accept these types of deposits. And many banks do. Hopefully all of them know that they are doing it, and so that they're remaining compliant with their Bank Secrecy Act requirements, which is what is the expensive part and is the tricky part. But it is possible. The federal government, the Department of Treasury has said, you can do this. This is how it's done. It's just a matter of the financial institutions being comfortable in their ability to do it without being prosecuted under federal law. And given the uncertainty at the federal level, until we have some statements, specific statements from the new administration, a lot of them are still pretty uneasy because they just don't know if that guidance is going to change like that.
Including myself.
I wouldn't do it.
We were going to have to leave it on that note. I realize you didn't get through everything, but I very much appreciate this, your background and your responsibility. And in spite of all of these questions about regulation that we have and enforcement, our real purview here today with Senate Bill 845 we want to keep working on is in some ways easier. We just have to decide where the money from the tax proceeds go. But this has been a good day of background for us. We really haven't had any. This is our first drink of water, or I should say first puff on this issue. And we'll come back to it, and we may need to lean on you again for your expertise.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So thank you. And Mr. Bovet, we're going to have to have you come back next time. So, okay. All right.
Interesting.
More homework. Think about where this money should go, what was in the original measure, what's in this bill. And we'll get back to it. We're adjourned until tomorrow at 8:30. We're adjourned until tomorrow at 8:30.